Welcome to Special Sauce, a Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
And then you go down there and like the first dish I have is like peri-peri prawns. I'm like, whoa, this is like really good, really spicy. I'm tearing, sweating. And I just started taking notes, extensive notes. Or like,
when and I assume the Ghanaian chefs were laughing at you.
Yes, a lot of ignorant moments for myself. I'm not going to lie.
This week, we are thrilled to be talking to Chef J.J. Johnson. J.J. is the co-author of Between Harlem and Heaven, Afro-Asian American Cooking for Big Nights, Weeknights, and Every Day. J.J.'s restaurant, The Cecil, was named the best new restaurant of 2014 by Esquire magazine. Welcome to Special Sauce, J.J. Johnson. So good to have you.
Thank you for having me.
I have many questions for you, but we got to start with what we usually start with, which is I want to hear about life at the Johnson family table growing up.
Ooh, life at the Johnson family table growing up was very great. I'm from Pennsylvania, the Northeast, Poconos. That time I grew up, there was, I can see it, it was a Burger King, a Pizza Hut, and an A&P. Those were your options in like a local diner.
Right.
But at the table, you know, I grew up with a diverse household. My dad's African American. My mom's Puerto Rican and Bajan. My grandfather's from Barbados. So my grandmother at that time cooking was Puerto Rican. So we used to have these like very diverse, cultural, crazy meals. Like she used to make her own chicken stock. She's like grind her own. She used to have this like spice cabinet with all these spices and jars. And I was like this young kid that would peel vegetables. And that was at my grandmother's house we can walk to every day. But then at my mom's house was this typical American barbecue chicken. I can name every day what my mom cooked.
And what did your mother think about what you were doing at your grandmother's? Like, were you into the kitchen and into the cooking thing even early on?
Yeah, I didn't really watch cartoons. I think I watched like Mr. Rogers and then ran to the kitchen and started thinking that I was doing something. But it definitely helped me along my way where I am now.
And what were you doing? And how old were you when you started doing it?
I think I was like 4 years old. I would like step on like a milk crate.
really?
And she would give me a peeler, which was probably like a phony play peeler, like Fisher Price. And I would peel vegetables or I would scoop things out or I would think I was really helping. And that was like my playtime. But for my grandmother, she was retired and she really loved it. And, you know, at that time, I look back and I don't know how my grandfather did it, but she had her sisters living with her too. So two of my great aunts were in that household too that were also cooking beside me too, or force feeding me vegetables that I hated like beets and squash and purple yams. But as a kid, I always loved grapefruit with sugar on top.
So you were really doing your first stage at your grandmother's house at the age of four. Let's face it.
Exactly. You put it in that way, yes.
And what did your mother think of that?
I think my mom was just happy that she could go to work, be at ease. But as I got older and I would tell my mom I wanted to be a chef, she was kind of, you sure you want to do this? There's other things to do. It was just like that era in time of coming out of domestic blue-collar work. Why would you want to do that?
Right. Why would you want to work with your hands? Why don't you be a doctor or a lawyer or a nurse or whatever?
Exactly. That's what my mom would constantly preach. She was a teacher. My dad was a bookkeeper. So they were like real blue collar. My grandfather was a postal worker. But it was like, okay, we've worked really hard. You need to go to the best of the best. You need to be better than us. You need to figure this out.
So when you told them you wanted to be a chef, they're like, why are you hurtling backward in time?
Exactly. Why are you going backwards? I know you like being in the kitchen. It's fun. You can always cook for your family, but I think you need to be a politician. things.
And how did you reconcile that? Like, how was it resolved?
I grew up in a grade two family household, so my dad was always like, follow your dreams. I never really was able to grow up and follow my dreams. So as I was going to basketball practice with my dad, he would say to me, hey, at the age of like 10, 11, 12, and 13, hey, you really want to be a chef? Follow your dream. Go with your gut. Do what you want to do because you really can't live life like you coulda, shoulda, woulda.
So your father was saying, follow your dreams. Mm-hmm. And your mother was saying, not so fast, JJ.
Right. So in the house, my mom was saying that. And when we would get out the house and my dad would take me to basketball practice or something else, he would tell us, make sure you do what you want to do in life.
So you were getting mixed messages, it seems to me.
Yeah. And I think I learned, like, you can use both of your parents for great things. You know, like, I still use both of my parents for different aspects in life today. Or I use them together at the table and see how they both react about certain areas.
And how did you end up going to culinary school?
So I saw a commercial back then for Culinary Institute of America. Mm-hmm. When they used to run commercials. And I just said one day, I was like 9, I was like, I'm going to go to that school.
At 9?
Yeah.
That's really applying early decision.
Really? I think I was just built that way. But yeah, so I saw this Culinary Institute of America that always stuck in the back of my mind. I worked at a country club in Pocono Farms that I would ride my bike to. And I just started meeting people, and they would tell me, oh, you should look at Johnson & Wales, or you should look here. So we went to go visit colleges. We went to Johnson & Wales. We went to Culinary Institute of America. I wanted to go check out New England Culinary Institute, but once I saw CIA...
You were down.
I was down.
And so you went to CIA, and what was your experience like there? Because, you know, people have many different reactions to their time at CIA.
Oh, I love CIA. Shoot. I remember going there for my walkthrough visit, because back then it was really, people that have been there before me was like, well, your time really wasn't intense, but you had to have at least a year experience, and you had to have all these recommendations from people that actually went to school there. I didn't know anybody that went to school there. So I got more than 3 recommendations. I just got so many people that could just give me as many recommendations as at hand. And then I had to do an in-person interview. So I dressed up in a suit. I went there. My parents drove me up. They waited in the car. I went in. It was like 1 hour and 20 minutes. I came out. We got lunch on campus. I went home. My dad said, how do you think it went? I said, I think it went well. And we waited 6 months till we got a letter.
And you were really happy. You're like that McDonald's commercial.
Right, exactly. Or those, like, young kids that just, like, both got accepted. One kid got accepted to Harvard. Like, if I had people behind me, I would have been the same way.
Right.
So it was great. And I think for my mom, it was like, well, I'm going to the best culinary school.
So you were going to the Harvard of culinary schools.
Right. And
so she felt good about that.
Yeah, she felt as good as I think she could feel.
You definitely qualified that.
And she said, oh, this costs a lot of money for culinary school. We got we didn't get any financial aid.
Really? And that's, you know, that's the not so deep and not so dark, dirty secret about culinary school. It's an incredibly expensive proposition to come out to make $10 or $12 an hour.
Yeah, it is really, yeah, right. So I think that was my mom's justification. Like, okay, we're going to spend $42,000 a year over 2 years. That's $84,000. But you're going to stay to get your bachelor's. So that's now $160,000.
Right.
The average income shows you make $42,000 a year. That's less than a teacher. How are you going to pay this back?
Yeah, JJ, you really need to go back to school to learn that this really is not a calculation you want to be making.
Right. So kind of like figured it out along the way. In my mind, I was hope that I would make more than $42,000 a year. I looked at the culinary world at that time really starting to shift and make a change in how people, everyday people, were judging it. There were these major chefs on TV making an impact, right? Emeril Lagasse was making food cool.
Mario Batali and all those guys.
All those guys are making this food cool, right? And making people believe in food different than how anybody really was looking at it. So I was hoping that with what they were doing and my everyday drive that I would make hopefully $75,000 minimum income.
Right.
Running a restaurant, and that would pay back my student loans, and I would be able to raise a family and put them through college, you know, all those things. And that's kind of where we left off. But, you know, I left Culinary Institute of America after I graduated. I took a year off.
So you actually got your BA there?
Yeah. Well, I got my associate's first.
Right. And then you're...
And then I went back, got my bachelor's because I agreed with my mom to get my bachelor's.
Got it.
And I look back in that year off and going back to culinary school to get my bachelor's, I looked at the culinary world really different. I looked at what professors and chefs were telling me. Like, I understood what they were talking about versus somebody that's just been in an institution for 3 years and not really picking up a knife.
You mean that year off?
That year off,
where
yes.
you were cooking in restaurants gave you perspective that you would otherwise not have gotten.
We've never have gotten, or we've never been able to have the conversations that I was having with chefs.
When you did get your bachelor's.
When I did degree. Get my bachelor's, right.
Got it. So what happened? Where did you go?
The best advice I think I got in culinary school, a chef said to me, when you graduate, you will not take a line cook position. And I said, why not? He said, you will take a junior sous chef position, and because you will work the line, but you will also do inventory. You will also be responsible of somebody, and this will help you grow. If you take a line cook position, you're going to pigeonhole yourself, and it's going to take you a really long time to grow. So long story short, I've never really shared this, but I took a management and training program at Wegmans.
You did?
Yeah. So I used to drive from my parents' house in Pennsylvania to like South Jersey.
Wow.
And it was the worst. And I was in this management training program at Wegmans. I did not like it. And at that time, who would think that prepared foods was going to be like this thing? And I was getting trained about prepared foods. I was like, man, I went to culinary school. I didn't come here to cook for people like this.
Right, to make rotisserie chicken for 500 people.
Like, this is bizarre. And it wasn't really the management and training program in my mind what I envisioned. So I just kept looking online. I saw this junior sous chef position at Jane.
Which is a restaurant that was in New York City.
Yeah, it was a restaurant that was in New York City. I heard it just recently closed.
Yeah.
And I applied. I got called back for a stage. So I said, I met this cook one time. He said, before you ever take a stage at a restaurant, go there and eat. So I went there and ate. I liked the food. I staged. I got the job offer. And Brian Ellis at that time was the executive chef who used to work for Rocco DiSpirito. There was something about him that connect, like, I was like, okay, I could be like this guy.
Mm-hmm.
His sous chef was Jason Heiselman, who I went to college with. And so it felt like a family from the jump, and they were talking about opening up this restaurant that's now called The Smith. And I went there and I was in it, right? I had to help be a junior. I was on the line. I burned my hand on the first day.
That's a rite of passage for a chef. You only burned your hand once?
Well, that I'll never forget that day. But
why? What happened?
Because I grabbed the pan out the oven with no side towel in the middle of service. And I remember Brian looking at me like, hey, man, you can't stop. You have to figure out how to work through this. And I worked through this hand, rubbed my hand with like salt. I don't know, salt was doing the trick for me.
And then didn't go to the doctor until after service was over?
I don't even think I came back to work the next day.
With your hand blistered?
Yeah, for some reason, my left hand had like this scar straight across with blisters. But it was like, what? It's my second day of work. I'm going to call out? But definitely, this is a fire at will state. I'm never going to get I can't lose out on this opportunity.
Right.
And I just stayed there for 2.5 years. And then I went to go work at Central Vinoteca with Leah Cohen.
Uh-huh.
Amber Burrell just left. She was on Top Chef. She was like, yo, I need a suit. She was reaching out to all her friends. And I went there. And I was only there for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
The restaurant was on its way closing.
Right.
And again, I applied. And I wound up working at Morgan Stanley Executive Dining Room.
Right, which a lot of people love because they're regular hours. You get paid well as the chef at an investment bank.
Correct.
And they stop there because, like, hey, this allows me to have a normal life. But you had bigger things in mind.
Yeah, I mean, it was great. We changed our menu every day. I worked for Zach Friedman. He worked at Chantrell of Madison Park, so I was learning from him. I mean, all the vendors I use today are the same vendors I used then. But, you know, it's interesting how people think that way of life is different than the restaurants. If you really think about it, you're in there at 5:30 in the morning and you don't leave at 7. You just happen to have Saturday and Sunday off.
Right.
And
but you're leaving at 7 instead of midnight.
Right. It's still 10 hours, 12 hours.
Right. That's true.
But, yeah, maybe set 5:30 is – but, yeah, you're right because 5:30 is like – union workers go to work at 5:30, so in the perception of the world, but for me, 5:30 is brutal.
Right.
But yeah, you do get off on the weekends. You do when nobody's there, when the big guys are not there, big guys and big girls are not there, you're off. There is a stop sign that stops you sometimes to say, now you can go be with who you love.
Right.
Right, because everybody else is. Well, when you're in the restaurant, you have to create that desire to make sure that you put a stop sign up for your employees or the business to make sure you can still be open, but everybody can still have their life. And that's the one thing I did learn from there that I do bring with me, which I think makes me well-rounded when I'm working back in the private sector.
Got it. So what happened from Morgan Stanley?
I went back to the industry and I started applying for jobs for chef de cuisine or executive chef positions. I would make it to like these final interviews and then I would get these emails that would say, thank you, but no thank you. And then I would...
Always lovely emails.
Right. But after a while, I was like, hold on, I've got like 10 of these emails. I'm going to start emailing these chefs back and say, what could I do? Right? Because sometimes a negative can equal a positive. What can I do to...
get you to yes.
Right. Somewhere. And I would get some, well, you were in corporate America and that's so different now. But I was like, hey, man, I worked in 5 restaurants that were in the private world before I worked here for 2 years. That's only like a quarter of my resume.
Right.
And
but
I
it
probably,
was the last thing on it, and right. So they were pigeonholing you.
Exactly. So I never got a job. So I was like, well, what can I do from... oh, I did get a job. I got a sous chef position offer at Arlington Club by the Tao Group. And I was like, well, that's me. I'm going backwards now, right? I'm going back to a regular sous.
Right.
For less money than I've ever made in my life. Less than when I was a junior sous.
Right.
Why would I do that? So at this time, TV, cooking on TV was the thing. I was applying for Chopped. I wasn't getting accepted there. And then a producer said, there's a show coming out on Bravo called Rocco's Dinner Party. You should apply. And I went on. I'd never done food television before.
Wow. You're a handsome dude,
oh,
though.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate that coming from you.
Coming from me? I'm just an old guy.
An old school G. And I wound up winning my episode, but I think the episode I was on had like really powerful culinary gods, right? You had Rocco, you had Marcus Samuelson. You had Kelly Klo Cho that was like a judge on Chopped Chef at that time.
Right, right. She was like, she used to do this show on the local right. WNYC channel.
So you had all these people that were talking about food, and I wound up winning that episode. And that wound up being watched by a gentleman named Alexander Smalls, and he felt like it hit home for him, and he gave me a call. Oh, he gave me an email, this long... I should go back and try to find that email.
Really?
This long email, but I never heard of Alexander before, you know?
But Alexander Smalls, I know because I'm old. I went to Cafe Beulah. I ate at the Lunchbox in Grand Central Station. You know, a lot of people don't know him.
Right.
He was a seminal African-American chef in this town.
100%.
Probably him and Patrick Clark, right? More than anything else. And so it's interesting that he reached out to you.
Yeah, he reached out, and his email, he wanted to meet me for breakfast at a place that was, 7 blocks from my house. I'm like, this is really weird now, not knowing that he lived 7 blocks north of that place,
right.
And this was 7 blocks south for him.
So
it really
worked
out. So you
both lived in Harlem.
Yeah.
And Alexander was, of course, you know, came out of low country cooking, for people who don't know. He was also this... amazingly successful opera singer.
Very successful opera
right?
singer.
Right?
Yeah.
Won like a Tony and.
Sang in Italy. I mean, the man's been everywhere and his voice is phenomenal if you ever get a chance to hear him sing in his home.
So you just started hanging out and talking about food. And at that point, did he have a deal with the Parsons to open the restaurant?
Yeah, so at that time he said, hey, I'm working on this concept with Richard Parsons. He's a dear friend of mine.
We should say that Richard Parsons at one point was the chairman of Time Warner, and before that was the head of the Dime Savings Bank, and is this major business figure in New York and really one of the first significant African-American business figures in this town.
Yeah, definitely in this town, and... you know, you can put his name at any table and people really know who he is. So, yeah, it was, you know, when you look at when he said that name and you go back and you call your parents and say, hey, I did this research on Richard Parsons. I know who he is. And your dad goes, it doesn't get any better than that.
Right.
Right.
And finally, your mom could feel good, man.
Yeah. Your mom's like, OK, what
you're
is
legit.
This? Like, right. Like you're legit now. Right. Somebody co-signed you.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, he said, hey, I'm working on this project in Harlem. I haven't really picked my chef yet, but I think you would be great. I am looking at 4 other people. I am going to have a black chef, and I'm looking all around the country. I've been doing extensive research. Let's keep in contact. And I'm a very big, like, follow-up person, so I would follow up with Alexander. We would meet for breakfast. At that time, he turned into a mentor for me. He knew I was applying for jobs. He would look at my resume. He would do all these things.
And you would be cooking for him at the same time.
Yeah, and then, you know, he would say, hey, I'm doing this dinner party at my house. You think you want to come by and bring, like, a dish or something? I would say, yeah, why not? But actually, before that actually happened, he said, hey, I got this call to go to Ghana, and they want me to cook, but I'm not cooking. Do you want to cook? And we could develop, you know, these American-themed dinners together.
Because he had sort of stopped cooking?
Yeah, he more is on the conceptual side.
Got it.
You know, like cooking in his house and saying, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? But actually, like, working on the line, the restaurant expediting, no.
Yeah.
You know?
So you went to Ghana with him?
Yeah, and I went to Ghana with him, and as we're on this trip, he started talking about the food of the African diaspora. And how African slaves and Chinese and Vietnamese migrant workers have come together through the last 100 years and they've formed this cuisine. I was like, man, what are you talking about? Never heard this in my life. I went to culinary school.
Right.
Like, I didn't have, nobody's ever talked about
this. Sounds like confusion cooking to me.
Right. What are you saying? And it's like, don't worry. We're going to go down there. We're going to check out some places. I want you to see it firsthand. We go there, and my only thing in my mind, right, because when you're cooking, you're, like, so focused on what you want to deliver, was cook these American-themed dinners, you know, barbecue night or, you know.
Fried chicken,
fried
whatever.
Chicken night, you know, all these.
Gumbo.
Gumbo night, right, all these American staples. And my American staples are way different than his American staples, so it was good to, like, bring those two together. And then you go down there, and, like, the first dish I have is, like, peri-peri prawns. I'm like, whoa, this is, like, really good, really spicy. I'm tearing, sweating, but this is really good. And I just started taking notes, extensive notes, extensive notes. Or like,
when and I assume the Ghanaian chefs were laughing at you.
Yes, a lot of ignorant moments for myself. I'm not going to lie. A lot of very ignorant moments like, well, why don't you know that? And also a lot of ignorant moments from them, right? Because it shows you like what's just on television or what's in the newspaper is all you really believe. When they said, you know, I live in Harlem, like, oh my God, Harlem's so dangerous, man. Be safe. Like, this is what they would say to me, but
right.
That's what, when you read the newspapers for them or you watch movies, that's what you were seeing, like this dangerous place. And I'm like, no, man, Harlem is like cool, super cultural. People are friendly. You could even live there and you would feel at home. So yeah, I mean, a lot of ignorant moments, but you know, we ate at some of the best Chinese food I had was in Ghana.
Wow.
Or I remember eating like on the street and people cooking on woks. Or eating dishes called suya or watching people eat with their hands. And I would say, it's just a cultural thing. It's the way of life.
So Alexander's thinking turned out to be a lot more than conceptual.
Yeah, his thinking became way more than conceptual. And it also was a light bulb moment for me because I grew up in the diaspora, like having an African-American father and my mom being half Puerto Rican and West Indian. And I lived in this cultural household that I never thought of more than just that, and nobody ever told me more than this, right?
Right,
just my family. So there was these things that would happen, I would say, I remember that flavor or I remember that scent as a kid. So it really helped me develop of who I was and what I was becoming.
Mm-hmm. So he gave you the job. What was the Harlem restaurant scene when you first took the job?
I mean, the Harlem restaurant scene was, I think, was a twofold, right? First fold was all these classic places in Harlem, like Sylvia's, Melba's, Amy Roof's. Pan Pan, right?
Nobody remembers Pan Pan.
Right.
I love Pan Pan.
At that time, Lenox Lounge was still open.
Right.
And you had all the West African markets. You still had the bodegas selling Dominican food or Puerto Rican food in the back.
And the Senegalese restaurants on 116th Street.
So that was like the one fold, right? The Harlem that we all know. And then the second fold was like Marcus Samuelson, Red Rooster, right? Bringing this light and this new outlook to this new renaissance to Harlem. And you had him. And he was in the forefront. And then you had us.
Right. And he was a galvanizing figure and he's charismatic and he's,
right.
You know, so he was getting a lot of attention.
I think at that time, They were on, I think, Red Rooster opened about 4 years at that time. So for another, like, big, what I call, like, not mom and pop, real restaurant opening, right? Not ordering at the counter, paying people livable wage, opening up next, that wasn't on, like, a main street, was off the beaten path, but happened to be in this historical building, because Cecil and Minton's are in this historical building.
Right.
Was really
yeah.
bigger than us. When we first started, I was just a chef at the Cecil.
And Minton's, which was the jazz club,
right.
also in the same building, had a different chef.
It was ran by Banks White.
Got it.
Who was from California. Really good dude, super talented. So yeah, and me and him used to look at each other like, you sure we want to open up 30 days apart? Like, let's do one. Well, somebody can assist the other person.
Right.
And then let's wait 6-7 months and do the other. But they had it in their mind, so we opened up two side by side. I mean, when the Cecil opened up, it was like this automatic hit. People were coming in, people were excited, people didn't know what to expect. What's Afro-Asian? You know, Joshua David Stein was one of the first people to write.
Oh, that's interesting. Even before Josh Zersky.
It's interesting. They debate on who wrote first. And,
and Josh is no longer with us, we should say, so the debate is hard to settle.
Right, but I think there's a podcast where they're arguing about it, or they wrote about it at the same time.
Right.
It was impactful. Like, it sparked a neighborhood that had sparked, but sparked it in a totally different way. Because I don't think many people realize this, but, like, Harlem makeup is very West African. And then the other makeup is very Chinese, Indian, Southeast Asian. And there's a great cookbook that talks about it called Bengali Harlem.
Really?
Yeah. And it just happens because when people were migrating to New York City, they were going into these hubs and these communities. And we still see it. I mean, the makeup's changing now.
Right.
But this was the area of some of those cultures that where they were going.
Fascinating.
So for us, it really, like, sparked. I mean, people were coming that you would never think would come there, but it was like home for them.
Yeah, interesting. And you attracted people from the neighborhood and obviously from outside the neighborhood.
Yeah, people were coming from all over the country, the world. I mean, when Josh Zersky wrote about us, people were coming from off the plane to the restaurant. I mean, that was just some unreal shit. So,
because the Cecil was integrated into Minton's, which was a legendary jazz club, mm-hmm. for people who don't know, where Charlie Parker played. And I actually spent many years in the jazz business, which you probably don't know.
I didn't know that.
For 14 years, I like ran jazz clubs and produced records and took saxophone lessons with Jimmy Heath. And so let's talk about the relationship between music and food for you.
When I first, you know, as a chef, you cook in the kitchen, the prep guys and girls have music blasting, right, which speaks to them, help them get through the day. When I'm developing recipes, I'm listening to Frank Ocean. For some reason, his music brings me to this, like, area of peace and creativity. But the one thing I learned at Cecil and Minton's was that music is nostalgic and it brings you somewhere and it makes you happy. Just as much or more than what food does.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was developing my playlist at Chef's Club.
Which is what you did, what you've been doing the last few months of 2017.
Right. Music was, like, really big for me. Like, it was bigger than the menu. It was like, how can we make music, like, craveable?
Right. And do you think that was from your experience at the Cecil and Minton's?
Yeah, I think there, you know, Parsons is a huge jazz
fan.
So jazz music to him and Alexander was this, like, craveable moment for some people. But as we all know, jazz is, like, very hard. I mean, I think it's going to come back really strong. I'm paying attention to it, and you probably do too. Having people like Christian Scott and John Baptiste in the forefront.
Yeah.
Really. And the cool fact that makes people, yeah. young people like
John who? Baptiste, you know, comes from a family, sort of one of the first families of New Orleans.
Right.
Black music, so.
Yeah, so, you know, when you have something like that, and he played at Minton's. So, yeah, I think paying attention to that, you know, you kind of look back and say, who kind of shaped who you are and what you're doing? So, for me, you know, music that I think is craveable to people or make people happy is 90s hip-hop and R&B.
Right.
I think it just does something. It's sing-along music. It brings you to a happy place. And then if you can accompany that with some really good food, it just is a win.
Got it. So let's talk about being a chef and race, because there isn't a long tradition in the 20th century of African-Americans playing a central role in restaurant kitchens. Obviously, we talked about Patrick Clark. There was Rudy, I can't remember his name, in New Orleans. There was Leah Chase. How did you find the racial climate of kitchens that you worked in?
I mean, still to this day, you might think I'm crazy I say this. Like, I don't see color. Like, that's real. That's the way I was raised. Like, we're all equal. We're all the same. We all bleed the same. But when you think about it, everybody doesn't look at it that way. And maybe sometimes some people make me see color. And I've had my fair shares where I've worked in kitchens where somebody would say, oh, you're Mexican, right? And I'm like, bro, what are you talking? Like, I would just laugh like, this is a joke, right? What are you talking about?
Right.
There'd be no Mexicans in the kitchen.
Right.
What are you talking about?
But they had to pigeonhole you.
But they had to, they had to pigeonhole me some way. And I also think I was lucky, you know, like I worked at Tribeca Grill, and Drew Nipram had a very, you know, at that era in 2002, it was diverse, you know,
like the kitchen was already diverse.
In his kitchen, you know, I worked with Kamal, who wound up being his executive chef later on. Now worked with Stephen Lewandowski, but Stephen Lewandowski ran that kitchen, and you had Mexicans, El Salvadorians, Italians, Greece, African Americans, Dominicans, Puerto Ricans. You had everybody flowing through that kitchen. That was a big kitchen. We used to do
right.
big numbers. So when I look back at that, I was really lucky. But I would say, like, at the high level, there's maybe one African American in the kitchen.
Yeah. I mean, but what you're saying is interesting, because you're saying the diversity existed in kitchens. It just didn't include many African Americans.
Oh, right. Yeah. I mean, it's. I would say, if I could sum this up for you, when I listen to chefs say there's not enough people to hire, I completely laugh out of frustration.
Right.
Because if you go in to look at any of the kitchens that I personally run, my kitchens are diverse. My kitchen probably speaks up to 10 different languages. And I knock on wood, hope this is wood, I've not had a problem hiring in any kitchen that I've been at the helm, because I take the best possible person,
right.
not because of the color of their skin.
Right. So you don't see color. And you didn't see people seeing color, because there was already, it's an interesting point that there was already so much diversity in restaurant kitchens by the time you were there. It just wasn't diversity that included African Americans.
No, there was no diversity including African Americans, but they're applying to jobs, men and women. And are they getting real opportunities? No, maybe because my name is my name is Joseph Johnson. You don't know who I am when I apply.
Right. But see, when I see the name J.J. Johnson, I think of the famous jazz trombone player.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you.
Who, by the way, happens to share my birthday.
Oh, that's even better now.
Yeah. Mozart and J.J. Johnson share my birthday.
That's really cool. That's super cool. Fun fact. But yeah, I mean, so I think for myself, as I'm at the forefront of the industry and I'm of the new era, I'm very conscious about making sure that the place that we all work in represents the world we live in.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Sure.
And that we're able to learn from each other and give everybody equal opportunity, because it just doesn't happen.
Yeah. So JJ's going to stick around to tell us more about his book, and you'll hear that part of the conversation on this second episode of Special Sauce. So thanks for listening, Serious Eaters, and we'll see you next time. And thank you, JJ. It's been real, and we're going to keep going.
Thank you.